From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 24th day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, about the futures markets. And then a bit later, the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County will take up the cash grain markets with us. We'll discuss the agricultural weather forecast with the boys up at Chesapeake Energy. They're high atop the Chicago skyline on the 23rd floor of the Boeing building. And then in the second half hour, we'll continue our discussion from Friday with Paula Savante. She's with Rabobank Argentina. We had just gotten to what I thought was some pretty interesting conversation about how entrance into farming happened in Argentina and the way it differs from that in the United States. More on that during the Farming World, that in the second half hour of our program on some of these radio stations and always online at willag.org. And along the way, we'll hear from two extension specialists. Vince Davis will be in the Farming World, the second half of that program. And we'll talk more about replanting soybeans. And Gary Schnitke will be here to go through the 2009 FBFM aggregated records and what they show about corn and soybean production in the state of Illinois last year. You probably already know that it wasn't all that great, especially for the corn acres. Gary will have some of the very disappointing financial numbers. And it all happens right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
In Chicago, on this Monday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. Nearby July wheat down 4.5 cents. Settlement price at 460 to 7.5. September at 485, down 4.25. In December, 516.5, 3.5 lower. Kansas City hard red July lead option, 490.5 on the harvest month there, down 4.5 cents. July corn up 2 at 371. September 380, 3.25 higher. In December at 389, up 3.75. March contract at 401, 3.75 higher. July beans at 940.5, a settlement price down a half. August at 935, a penny and 3/4 higher. November at 915.5, up 8. And January beans at 924.75, up 8.75. The bean meal July contract 273.70, down $1.90. July oil at 37.52, 56 higher on the afternoon. June live cattle 91.12.5, down 25 cents. And the feeders May contract 108.7.5, down 67.5. And the June lean hog futures today at $81.87, down or rather up 42.5 cents per 100 pounds. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil, July contract, $70.26 a barrel, up 22 cents. Ethanol at $1.60.3, a penny and a tenth higher. Natural gas at $4.02, down a penny and a half for the day. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $1.90.6, 0.9 cents higher. And gold futures at $1,193.80 an ounce, a settlement price at $18.10 higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now just about 61 points lower at 10,133 for the afternoon. And the Goldman Sachs on the day at 473.82 is up 0.05 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast says. Tonight, clear to partly cloudy. Lows will range between 65 and 70 degrees. That's right. Those are the lows for the day. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, hot, humid, a few isolated showers, some thunderstorms that'll happen in the afternoon, mostly in western Illinois. And highs tomorrow will range between 87 and 93. The extended forecast says hot and humid weather will prevail across Illinois and Indiana and the Corn Belt for the next few days. High temperatures will be in the mid-80s to the mid-90s. Spotty, mostly afternoon and evening showers and thunderstorms will pop up, of course. Today, the best chance of rain will be near the Ohio River. Tomorrow and Wednesday, the best chance of thunderstorms will be in the western section of Illinois and then on westward from there. A weak cool front will slide southward across Illinois and Indiana Wednesday night and Thursday. That'll perhaps trigger a few more numerous scattered showers and thunderstorms. And then slightly cool air will settle in for the Memorial Day holiday weekend. However, it won't be cool. High temperatures should range from the upper 70s north to the mid-80s in the south. And the lows should range from the 50s in the north to the 60s in the south. A more complete and detailed look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and we talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is a Monday afternoon. On the line with us today to take a look at what's been happening in the world of agricultural futures is Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Tell me about this marketplace. It's kind of interesting to watch the numbers in the bean pit, especially because the back months are the next year's crop, or the one that's currently in the ground, jumped just a bit today. What happened?
A little bit of spread unwinding. Also, too, with the moisture we received here over the last 2 weeks, some areas are going to take a little while to dry out. Then, too, we're starting to see a little demand come forward for this new crop. Old crop's been pretty well sold and shipped, for say, but the new sales coming online now are based on this 2010 crop. This afternoon's planting progress expected to show all 50 to 60% of the beans in the ground as a nation. Some of those are going to have to be replanted a second time in a few areas there, but for the most part, bean crop's pretty good shape. Also, too, we're starting to see some more talk of China switching to U.S. beans, then even South Korea maybe switching some meal purchases from the southern hemisphere to the U.S. So overall, bean demand still remains fairly strong. The market was oversold basically from last week's price drop, Todd.
What do you make of the weather, and will it have much of an impact in the marketplace? It's pretty early to have 90 degrees.
Oh, boy, one extreme to the other. I never thought we'd go from spring to August in just a matter of a few days. We're going to see probably the extremes in this weather pattern. The forecast is relatively warm for a day or two. The longer-term maps are indicating a little bit of ridge action, below normal precip. So last thing we want to see as a producer is the moisture go from plentiful to nil, because that's been really stressful in the past.
Will the marketplace set up and take notice of it anytime soon?
Not anytime real soon. I think the market's probably going to keep an eye on the outside markets more closely than the near-term weather pattern. If we would happen to see an extended weather concern pattern develop here for 2 to 3 weeks, then I think we could probably see the public start to get involved and see some market action due to the forecast. This is going to take 2 or 3 weeks. Typically, you get into mid-June, the overnight forecast would be more dramatic than the overnight forecast here at the end of May.
You mentioned the outside markets. Any new news or rumors from there that we should be paying attention to?
Oh, more of talk of bank situations in France and Europe in general and Spain. We're going to continue to hear that news unwind as time goes on. They've got some problems they got to work through, and it's just going to take some time, but that economic uncertainty is just not going to go away, for say. But I think no major outbreak has given the overall traders a little bit of comfort today. Last week, I think we were in risk management mode. A lot of traders were out of the office, for say, at a big convention, and they're all together, and they're all bearish, all thinking along the same track or hearing the same bearish news. And I think portfolio management was in line last week, but making it through the weekend without any major collapses, for say, sort of restored a little bit of confidence in the marketplace. But it's just going to take time for that to heal up, Todd.
The Dow not very far, really, above the 10,000 mark. How important is it to hold above that?
Well, psychological-wise, we can stay above it, but the big thing is for not only the stock indexes, but these individual companies for stays to get it back above their 200-day moving averages and some even shorter-term 40, 50-day moving averages that would generate some buy programs to kick back in. Also, too, we get towards the end of the month, first of the month, where we see IRA money come back into the market, new investment money come back into the market. Hopefully that'll give some support to the whole complex as a whole.
And there's some carry in the corn market from the December to the July, what, about 25 cents or there about it at the end of the afternoon today. How important is it for a farmer to consider that as he makes his marketing decisions?
Well, each individual's got different operations set up, but for those who particularly want to capture some carry, that's the way to go. Even if you look at cash bids versus futures, there's quite a bit of carry by just hedging the futures contracts. And on-farm storage, you know, you can head deferred there and, you know, operate as an own individual elevator for, say, and capture that margin there. Because as we get into this fall and next early winter, we feel that demand is going to be a little bit stronger and this basis is going to firm up and be better than where it is today. And if you pick up the extra 20, 30 cents, that adds up over quite a few bushels.
Do we know anything more today than we did when the trade ended its day on Friday about China and its want or need to import corn from the United States?
Well, there's been a lot of conversation. There's going to continue to be a lot of conversation. Reading between the lines, we feel it's bullish longer term. When you have a country come in and say, oh, grain prices are going to be stable due to ample stocks, but yet they're buying grain, that's kind of a red flag. Also, too, when you hear comments about China can meet their corn demand with the reserves, you know, those statements are kind of puzzling when you kind of read between the lines. We feel, though, that in order to be big-time bullish corn, that Chinese corn demand or Chinese are going to have to buy more than just 2 to 3 million metric tons of U.S. corn. Each metric ton, rounded off, is 40 million bushels. They buy three of those, that's 120 million bushels. Now you start getting above 3 million metric tons or 120 million bushels, that could start being a dynamic effect to the marketplace. So if they continue to buy, I think that's going to be a huge plus as we move down the road.
You know, when we had the pop in the corn market on Friday, there was some selling into the marketplace by farmers. Will they continue that today, and should they do it?
We didn't recommend any sales today other than catch up. We feel we need to continue to push this crop out the door. As a producer, we feel the downside risk is still there and still valid going into midsummer. We feel, though, that after this surge up, if you did not make sales and went for some higher levels, we'd put orders in corn about 10 cents above where we closed here today, and on beans 15 cents above where we closed here today to make some additional sales.
Kurt, we thank you so much.
Very good.
That's Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. Happens each and every Monday afternoon.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to Cooley at admworld.com.
And if you'd like to hear what Kurt had to say again, you can always do that on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. There you can sign up for our podcast. They'll be delivered to your computer automatically. For our email weekend newsletter, that too will come to you automatically. And if you give us your phone number, your mobile phone number, we'll text you on the important USDA day report days, all for free. It's all at willag.org. This is a Farm Doc podcast. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. In studio with us today, Farm Management Specialist Gary Schnitke from the U of I. Just penned a brand new FEFO. That stands for Farm Economics Facts and Opinion piece. You can find the article online at the Farm Doc website, www.farmdoc.illinois.edu. It's titled Revised Corn and Soybean Budgets for 2009 and 2010. Mr. Schnitke, Why did you revise them?
Illinois Farm Business Farm Management has recently summarized their financial results for 6,000 farms in Illinois, and we use that to update our 2009 budget so that they're based all on actual farm data.
Give me some of the initial thoughts on the data and how it changed.
Well, as expected, farm or non-land farm costs were extremely high in 2009. Non-land farm costs came in at $533 per acre, which is up considerably from 2008, and that 2008 number is about $120 lower than the $533 that we saw in 2009.
There were three categories that changed considerably that contributed to those increased non-farmland costs. What were they?
They were fertilizer. We saw fertilizer cost at $185 an acre, which is up over $60 from the previous year. Seed costs were $90 an acre for corn, and that was up over $20 from the previous year. And drying costs were $38 an acre, which were up from the previous year due to high moisture corn in the fall.
Notably, machinery cost and depreciation there increased as well.
Yep, machinery depreciation was $35 an acre, which is up $6 from a previous year. And a lot of that increase can be attributed to capital purchases in 2007 and 2008 when we had pretty good farm incomes.
That's a good news, bad news kind of category. The bad news is depreciation was up. The good news was there was money to spend on brand new machinery. Two cost categories had decreases. What were those?
Crop insurance went down. We saw crop insurance go down $6 to $21 an acre. That was primarily due to higher premium discounts on enterprise units, and farmers took advantage of it. The other one was fuel cost, which went down to $13 an acre, which is down about $9 from the previous year. Again, fuel prices were lower in 2009 than in 2008.
Then you add it all up and do the subtraction, and what did the revenues look like?
We did this, and we're showing this in our FEFO for cash rent farmland. And in cash rent farmland, we are showing a minus $29 return for corn, plus $66 for soybeans. Corn was below zero for the first time in a long while, and that was because of a very high cost in 2009.
And then you make some projections about 2010.
We're projecting non-land costs coming down and net returns to be $45 for corn and minus $9 for soybeans. Those returns, when you average them together, are close to the 2001 through 2003 levels back several years.
You can find all the stats and the figures and the tables that go along with the revised corn and soybean budgets for 2009 and 2010 article on the FarmDoc website. It's at www.farmdoc.illinois.edu. Gary Schnittke, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Gary Schnittke is a farm management specialist from the University of Illinois and a member of the FarmDoc team and an ag economist. You can always have his podcast delivered to you automatically if you'd like. Just visit farmdoc.illinois.edu, or you can listen to him here on WILLAG.org during the closing market report. You can visit that website too if you'd like. It's all about service, and the important part is you. Please do remember that. I know that I haven't thanked you for a while for listening, so I'll take that time now. Thank you so much for listening. I do appreciate that fact, and we are very hopeful that the program we produce is worthwhile to you and what you do on your farming operation.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
One quick programming note here. Wednesday afternoon on the Farming World, that's the second half hour of this program on some of these radio stations and online after the fact at willag.org. That's WILLAG.org. Gary Schnitke will be in the studio live along with Doug Yoder from the Farm Bureau out of Bloomington, Illinois. He's with the State Farm Bureau there, and we'll be talking about the ACRE program. I'm still not quite sure whether we're going to take your calls live at that point, but if you email me to tgleason@illinois.edu or give me a call at 333-9697, there's a 217 area code in front of that, 217-333-9697, and you've got questions about ACRE sign up as of June 1. You have to have that done if you haven't already. Please do send them along to me, and we'll try to get to those on Wednesday afternoon of this week during the program we call The Farming World. Now, time for our look at the cash grain market on a Monday afternoon. Greg Johnson of the Andersons right here in Champaign County joins us. Good afternoon to you, Greg.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Farmers on Friday, I suppose, in your area, did they take advantage of the little uptick in the corn market?
Oh, a few did, but not really. We're right back to the, even with the rally, it seemed like a big rally, but we only finished up 6 cents for the week. And we're right back in the middle. These corn has been in that $3.70 to $4 range forever, and we closed today at $3.85. So we're right in the middle. I think if we could get in the upper end of that range, farmers would let loose of both old crop and new crop. But until then, I think most of them have decided to be patient.
Be patient and wait for what, $3.90 and above?
I think so. I think, you know, with all the, you know, all the concerns about the crop, you know, we're off to a good start in places around here especially, but we've got a lot of hurdles to get over with yet, and the fact that it's 90 degrees already in May has already got some people nervous and more willing to believe in forecasters talking about hot and dry as we get into June and July. So, you know, we've got a ways to go, and I don't think 15 cents is too much to ask for.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about a supply on hand of corn and soybeans that's usable by the end users at this point, old crop, and what you think it looks like and how the months of into May and June and July might fold out.
Well, I think there's still plenty of corn available, plenty of old crop corn available. You know, when the market goes down, farmers, you know, with still 3 or 4 months to go in the marketing year, have been tight holders. But we've seen in the past, anytime we rally up to those recent highs, farmers let loose of that corn, and I still think there's a lot left to go. Beans are just the opposite. Most farmers took advantage of analyst recommendation to sell beans last fall and early winter, and so there's very few old crop beans left. The good news is they sold them at much higher futures prices, even though the basis levels weren't as good back then. So, you know, basis levels have really improved, but the futures price is down at the bottom of the range, so I think the farmers did the right thing.
Is the fact that those beans are in the hands of the end user, I suppose, or the elevator, one of the two, does that change very much what happens as we go through the end of the marketing year because of availability? There's still a pretty good size carry out. So it doesn't mean that, does it mean the supply gets tight at the end of the year, or is it just that they're in different hands?
I think you'll see a tighter situation because commercials will not carry beans through an inverse. A farmer might because he's more looking at the flat price and what a commercial elevator is. So, yeah, I think beans will be tight, and they'll be really screaming for those first new crop beans that come off the first week or two.
All right, so they should be watching for that, and bases could close up pretty nicely and maybe go to an inverse then, I suppose.
Exactly.
All right, and then tell me about cash grain bids at this point and what basis looks like.
Okay, basis levels have been improving in beans tremendously. Corn basis just hanging in there steady. We're paying $3.59 for old crop corn, up to $3.59 also for the new crop corn. Old beans $9.35, new beans $8.75. And for those two or three farmers that did actually get some wheat planted, we're paying $4.37 for wheat this summer.
All right. Thanks much.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Greg Johnson. He's with the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Joins us on the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Stay with us. We'll have a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast in just 2 minutes when we talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy.
It's National Escargot Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1686, Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit was born. He developed the Fahrenheit temperature scale and invented the mercury thermometer. Fahrenheit discovered, among other things, that water can remain liquid below its freezing point and that the boiling point of liquids varies with atmospheric pressure. In 1844, Samuel Morse transmitted the message, "What hath God wrought?" from the U.S. Supreme Court to the Mount Clair station of the B&O Railway Company, the first American telegraph line. By the way, the biblical text from Numbers was selected by Annie Ellsworth, teenage daughter of the Commissioner of U.S. Patents. In 1883, the Brooklyn Bridge opened. It took 14 years to build at a cost of $18 million and was the longest suspension bridge in the world at the time. In 1945, the first Food-O-Met was installed in a Grand Union Company store in New Jersey. And in 1964, Alan Hazelton died, an American electrical engineer. He invented the first circuit, which made commercial radio possible. By 1927, some 10 million receivers with his circuit were being used by listeners in the United States. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On this Monday afternoon, we're joined by Mark Russo at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Mark.
Good afternoon, Todd.
It's hot. Looks like it's going to stay that way.
Well, stay that way, particularly over the next few days here before we see a little bit of a cool down, albeit still temperatures will remain at warmer than normal levels throughout the week. Bottom line is that for the next 10 days, it's a warmer than average pattern here across the Midwest. And then thereafter, it does look like temperatures will retreat back down to more normal levels. But again, that is after the next 10 days.
How much more warmer than usual are we?
Well, for example, over the next if you average out temperatures over the next 4 to 5 days, temperatures will be about on the order of 8 to 13 degrees warmer than normal. And then as we get to the day 6 to 10 time frame, looks like temperatures retreat back down to slightly above normal levels of about 3 to 7 degrees warmer than normal.
Does that go for both daytime and nighttime highs?
That is correct. And if anything, your nighttime lows will be even more anomalous. A lot of that is just due to the humidity that you're seeing right now, having dew points in the 70s across much of the Midwest. So that's going to keep overnight temperatures on the high side, and yeah, that's exactly the case, Todd.
So when we've been wet and it's kind of humid and we've got a lot of moisture in the ground, it usually means we get pop-up showers and thunderstorms. Are those in the forecast too?
There are in scattered pockets here of the Midwest. Like, for example, you're seeing some isolated storms pop up across southern sections of Illinois here today. Tomorrow, that activity will become a little bit more widespread and encompass some of the southwestern portion of the Midwest, places like Missouri and even into southern Iowa. But overall here, you're not seeing any kind of big rain systems across the Midwest, per se, a little bit of rain activity here and there. It certainly is not as active of conditions as what's been observed over the past couple of weeks.
And then turn your attention to China for me. How are they faring at this point?
Yeah, China's improving a little bit here, especially in the province of Heilongjiang, where the pattern looks less active. Now, for reference here, Heilongjiang is one of your biggest soybean-producing areas there of China, but that has been one of the wettest areas and coldest areas so far this spring. And so that's beginning to improve. Less active pattern is on tap for northeastern China, although it's not bone dry. high, but certainly an improving pattern here, and that will at least make up a little bit of ground here across northeastern China from a corn and soybean planting standpoint.
Are there any concerns around the globe that we ought to pay some attention to that we haven't talked about?
Well, Todd, it's pretty quiet out there from any kind of major issues. Really, China is the most noteworthy weather, and that is delays in their planting. We're also seeing some delays in planting of spring wheat and canola across Canada. Again, not a big issue, but just something to watch since it's pushing crop development back this year.
Mark, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Todd.
Mark Russo is with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon. For some of you, we'll say goodbye. For the rest of you, stay with us for the farming world.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is the Farming World news and information from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. As we closed out our discussion Friday with Paula Savante of Argentina's division of Rabobank, we had just hit on the subject of how producers in Argentina came into the business. As most of you know, it's a very labor and finance-intensive business to get into, farming that is, and it happens just a bit differently in Argentina than it does in the United States. The Argentine farmer may not be buying any equipment at all and may only be responsible for purchasing the property and then managing that property and having it what we in the United States would call custom farmed. I followed up with Ms. Savante just a bit on the subject and asked her how that came about.
No, I think the difference is probably goes back to 100 years and how each country was originally formed. I think in Argentina, a lot of people already have the land. And the question is, and I don't think there's such a big separation between the people that live in the city and the people that live in the countryside. I think a lot of the people in the city do own hectares and do either rent it out. 50% of production in Argentina is done on land that is rented. So a lot of people today that maybe have inherited some land and don't want to be a doctor or want to be something else and don't want to take care of actually working the land, they just rent it out. And conversely, you can come into the business by renting land and by renting. All services here are outsourced, so you don't even need to own a tractor. Basically, you need to be, in a way, what has transformed the sector in the last few years is you can do a lot of things by outsourcing some services and renting land, and you don't even have to own the actual assets.
Oh, I see. Well, that does
Is that clear?
No, that makes it. That means you can be an absentee landlord and a manager if you're a good manager. Be inside the business to some extent, but not have to own anything other than the property. And then you're right. And so you can have others come in and custom farm your land for you, and that's widely available.
Yeah. In that case, you know, you might need to have some access to financing, but it's not, you don't necessarily need to own the land. Or if you do own a little bit of land, you can rent a lot more. So you can have a much bigger size than what you actually own in terms of land.
When you look at farm parcels and total farm parcels, so if I were a young farmer, what is a going property in size? Is it 5,000 hectares, 1,000 hectares, 500 hectares? It probably can be all of those, but
be all of those.
Yeah, but what's most widely popular? I would think about 1,000 acres here or better is considered in this part of the world. Corn and soybean production is considered a very going, the size that you really need to be at to make things work very well. The average size of the farm in the state of Illinois is about 840 acres, I think, for grains and oil seeds anyway.
Yeah. Like I said, there's all sorts of sizes. There's from 5,000 to 1,000 to 500 hectares. I would say, you know, 1,000 hectares, it's It's a very big producer that the sales are it's a large volume. I would say around 600 would be 600 hectares would be sort of a
which would be on the average size of what a farm in the state of Illinois might be as well, or close to it, I would think. But certainly dwarfed by the size of the production agriculture that takes place in Brazil in terms of land mass.
Well, yeah, but it's hard to talk about averages. Both Brazil and Argentina have a lot of very small farms that really don't produce much, and most of the production in terms of volume produced, happens in the larger farms, right? Definitely sizes in Argentina are lower than in Brazil, no question about that. And it's more likely that they're closer to sizes in the U.S. than to sizes in Brazil, definitely. Now, we also do have almost corporations, or they're not corporations, they're farm groups that, have expanded to grow in 200,000 hectares or more, that are growing in both Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay. You know, with this scheme where you can rent land and you can outsource all the services, etc., the expansion of some groups has been really impressive. And they've moved into Brazil as well.
These are cooperative groups, or are they corporations?
No, they're not cooperative groups. No.
So they're incorporated groups, and they rent the land as opposed to own it, or do they buy the farmland too?
No, they usually have a mix. Some of them have 50-50. Some of them have maybe, 30 owned and 70% that's rented. And some of them have also, aside from getting into the business of actually growing, they've come into the business of a sort of farm real estate, if you want to call it something like that, which is actually buying land, improving it, making it come into production, and then sell it. A lot of them have also done that.
Can I talk to you about another issue then, and maybe step out of your Rabobank area and back into your World Bank days, and I don't know whether you there or even at Rabobank discuss this very much. When you have land ownership in any place in the world that is corporatized as opposed to privatized, and I guess I make a distinction between those two, when you're tying land up in a corporation that could last for centuries as opposed to a private owner which has a finite time because they die. Are there problems, you think, that come with that kind of ownership?
Cooperation. Problems with cooperation, you mean, or problems with private?
No, with the corporately owned properties. And it may be something either you don't want to talk about, don't know about, or I may...
No, I'm sorry. I don't even think we have that here. So I'm not exactly sure what it entails.
Well, I was thinking of these farmers that have gotten together and they buy property together. Do they own it privately? So when they sign papers, are they signing the loans themselves? I mean, their name is on the title,
I'm sorry. No, usually they become sort of as if they're a company and they're buying a house or a building.
You know,
you're buying a piece of land as a company.
Well, and so what I was asking
it's not
then
an
was,
individual person.
So what I was asking was that as in your World Bank days, did you talk about the difference between privately held farmland or properties and corporately held or company owned properties and what problems that solves and or creates?
I mean, of course, when you're talking about corporate owned and you're talking about expanding sizes, you start worrying about whether, with a World Bank hat, right? Whether these might be displacing smaller farmers, right? That would be the biggest concern. But the truth is, if they're increasing the value of most of the land they work in, and they're renting a lot of it from people who initially own it, it's not such a big concern that you're displacing the previous owners. You understand what I mean?
Right. If they're renting the property, but if they go in and buy large tracts of land and they tie that land up in the company for hundreds of years as opposed to a lifetime.
Yeah. I guess I don't know what to answer to that, because it's been a market that's been so fluid, and so many of them are into this business of buying it and selling it. I feel it's mostly the people that hold on to the land forever, for generation and generation, rather than the companies.
I see.
But at the same time, they're fairly new, so I couldn't tell you what's going to happen 100 years from now. But I would say in Latin America, if you're talking about land distribution, the biggest problem is the private families that hold on to the land forever, right?
Well, we know full well that about the third or fourth generation down, that land gets dispersed fairly quickly and gets sold. And so the land doesn't really matter how much property that a person might be able to acquire in his or her lifetime, that their heirs, if probably not the second generation, but the third generation down, by the time it gets to be split up, are no longer farming or have no interest in that property and are more interested in building a home, for instance, and need the asset and the value of the land in order to invest in a company or build a home or whatever it is that they want to do, and that they sell that property, and then it goes back into the open marketplace to be purchased again. And so that it's not tied up for an extraordinarily long time in one family, just because it's diluted out and it's privately held. But
the thing is, I'm not sure I agree that is the way things are in Latin America. You know, land concentration is much bigger here than it is in the U.S., here and in Brazil, and in all of Latin America, actually. And maybe you have a point. Maybe the point is that these families...
Well, let
maybe
me
turn it into a corporation so that it stays with them forever.
Well, let me ask it differently, because here, I traveled to India, and the titles to land in India, and they don't transfer easily, and they're in very, very small plots, but that the title to a land in India is not titled to one or two people, but that land is owned by the entire family, and the entire family may include aunts and uncles and cousins, and that all of them must agree to make a sale. And so each of those properties continually get smaller over time because they don't make sales. They just divide it up, but there are too many people involved in the title to actually decide to make a sale of a property. And they get so small, in India anyway, that even those who have moved off of that property still feel some connection to their homeland, but there's so little to gain by the sale that they're not willing to give it up. And here in the United States, the title is not that way. The title is probably to the male in the family, or to the mother and father, but certainly not to the children in the family until it's passed on to them at the death of both of the parents.
And that's exactly the same in Argentina.
And so it works the same in Argentina. Oh, interesting.
Except what I'm saying, it works the same as in the U.S., not the same as in India.
Right. Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, what we see in these countries, if anything, is land concentration, not land division.
Paula Cervantes is with Rabobank Argentina, joined us here for our discussion on the farming world. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. When we come back, something a bit closer to home, we'll talk with Vince Davis, University of Illinois soybean specialist. I have a question for you, and it's pretty simple, though I need an honest answer. Many of you have called and written and talked to us just a bit about this program we call The Farming World. And you say, yes, we like The Farming World. We think it's a program that's worth listening to. I've also heard that it makes the program awfully long. An hour is a long time during your day. What I want to know honestly from you is whether you think it's worth doing or not. It's important to us to know whether this program, The Farming World, is something that makes a difference to you and helps you to understand agriculture. If not, we need to change The Farming World or to do something different. It certainly is a lot of work for both Dave Dickey and I. I don't want to get out of the work. I just want to know whether the work we're doing is worthwhile. So if you like it or if you don't like it, please do give me a call or write me an email. The numbers are 217-333-9697, that's 217-333-9697, or email to tgleason@illinois.edu. That's tgleason@illinois.edu. Please do be honest about the program. We really want to know whether it's worth your time and ours. You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Vince Davis, Extension Soybean Specialist from the OVIA, is here to talk about soybean replant. Mr. Davis, over the past week or so, many a farmer has been wondering whether the crooks will be broken and whether their stand will be good enough to make it through the whole season. What kind of advice have you been giving them as the phone calls have rolled in to you?
Yeah, there's just a lot of concerns out there right now, Todd, about soybeans that have been in the ground for 1 to 2 weeks ahead of all of these rains, and growers aren't seeing all of them come up yet. So there's a lot of question about whether they're going to have to replant some of the acres that have received a lot of rainfall and been under cool conditions in some of Illinois.
It happens fairly often, and I'll bet that you've got some advice on how they can go about reconsidering the replant and what they should do.
Well, I certainly wanted to stress that we haven't received a lot of growing degree units or heat units in the last 2 weeks. And in fact, for all of northern Illinois, north of Springfield, we haven't received greater than 150 heat units yet in the last 2 weeks as of today. And it takes at least 100 heat units and up to 150 heat units to get soybeans up and out of the ground, depending on depth that they were planted. And so it's not uncommon for the soybeans to not be up yet, but I know that some fields are very saturated, and so producers are worried that they could be rotting at this point.
And do you think?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do, or growers need to do, is kind of keep the emotion out of it and make sure they get out there and scout their fields really intently and scout the different areas of their fields pretty closely, because different areas of the fields, depending on elevation and drainage, could be very different in the number of plants that may survive or may emerge. And also, when plants do emerge, if they get emergence, they may get a partial emergence, and having a very accurate stand count of the seedlings that are going to survive are going to be very important into that decision as to what to do with it when they get the chance for it to be dry enough to do something again.
And I suppose producers will have an idea once the beans come up. They'll see them come up. So is that when they go out and start taking stand counts, and what numbers do they need to be watching for?
Yeah, well, I think growers can get out there as soon as it's dry enough to get across the field. They can get out there and start digging seedlings to find out whether or not those seeds have rotted or whether there is germination activity in those seeds before they see the plants. But certainly once they start to see the crooks come above the ground, they want to get out there and start assessing it just to get an early idea. But once the soybeans have come up out of the ground, they can go out then at that point and start to get an assessment of their actual plant stands that they're going to receive, with the idea that they still may have more to come if they don't have a lot of seedling rot in the rest of them. And at that point, they can certainly take a count to find out how many plants per acre they have. Now, this is where it gets really difficult in situations where they will have partial stands as to how many plants per acre would growers consider the cutoff as to whether they need to destroy the stand they have and start over, and or maybe just plant into that stand. In some of the data that I've had previously on seeding rates, I've shared many times and on the show before, I've said 100,000 uniformly spaced plants is the goal to have to maximize yield in a field. But for a replanting situation, really you can bring that number down by quite a bit more. At 50,000 uniformly spaced plants in a field, you can still easily achieve above 90% of your original target yield. And really, until you get down to about 35,000 plants or less is where you would get to be before you would be down in the range where you've lost up to a third of your yield potential. So if you're looking at a stand of at least 50,000 plants per acre, you can still be well above the 90% of your total expected yield potential. And at that point, you may be much better off to maintain that stand than you are to start over or add to it.
Yeah, and surprisingly enough, I think, but you can correct me, it doesn't matter whether you've put this in 30-inch rows or you've drilled them or they're in 15s in terms of what that plant population is. It's just total number of plants per acre, right?
That's right. Total number of plants per acre is probably more important than row spacing to a certain degree. Now, if we're talking about 50,000 plants or less, having them spread out uniformly with narrower rows in a drilled situation may be better than in row situations, but you can still do very well in 30-inch rows. Now, the number one key, if you're talking about plant stands of 50,000 or less that you're going to maintain, the number one key is probably going to be weed control at that point, because it is going to take an extended period to achieve canopy closure. So you're certainly going to want to be very aggressive at scouting and achieving weed control, or keeping that stand free of weed competition to induce quicker canopy closure to maximize yield.
But what if they have to replant at this point, or they haven't planted for the first time either? Are there things that they need to be considering under the wet conditions that we've had recently? For instance, do they need to use seed treatments more often now than they would have earlier in the season?
The biggest thing to probably keep in mind is we've had wet conditions, to probably not get too excited to plant under suboptimal conditions or wet conditions, because we don't want to compound sidewall compaction or other compaction issues, or more likely plant into wet conditions and then have it turn off hot and dry. Now, you asked about seed treatments. We're probably getting later in the season where seed treatments may be less of a benefit than what they may be for the seeds that have already been on the ground.
Vince Davis is an extension soybean specialist from the University of Illinois. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a great afternoon.